All this stuff was taken very seriously and hyped by the people on the outside, while the people on the inside could not get the CIA to go along with any of this.
A high-level correspondent at a top network actually wrote, "The war in Iraq was planned even before 9/11. 9/11 was just sort of the Vaseline that allowed it to happen faster."
One told me that for the heck of it, they put a thermometer down, you know, the shirt, to take a temperature reading of their body, and it was 145 degrees. And they're sitting on top of tanks at checkpoints. Many of them wear gloves because their guns become so hot they can't even hold them. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, July 22nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Saddam Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay, were reportedly killed today in a raid by U.S. forces who surrounded the home of a cousin, a senior U.S. official said. Two other Iraqis were also killed. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of the coalition Grand Forces in Baghdad, said investigators have received positive DNA testing to confirm the identities.
Today, our coalition forces associated with the 101st Airborne Division conducted an operation against suspected regime members. An Iraqi source informed the 101st Airborne Division on today that several suspects, including Qusay and Uday, numbers 2 and 3 on the U.S. Central Command's most wanted list, were hiding in a residence near the northern edge of the city. The six-hour operation began when the division's 2nd Brigade combat team approached the house and received small arms fire. The division subsequently employed multiple weapon systems to subdue the suspects who had barricaded themselves inside the house and continued to resist detention fiercely. Four persons were killed, and we have since confirmed that Uday and Qusay Hussein are among the dead. The site is currently being exploited. Four coalition soldiers were wounded in the operation, and I pray for their speedy recovery. The coalition is committed to working with the citizens of Iraq to maintain a safe and secure environment for all of its people, and we will continue to strive for a better quality of life for all Iraqis in this country.
The United States has offered a $25 million reward for information leading to Saddam's capture and $15 million each for his sons, who were top leaders in their father's regime. Fighting broke out after members of the 101st Airborne Division surrounded the Stone Column Villa, which belonged to one of Saddam's cousins, a key tribal leader in the region. The building was left charred and smoldering, its high facade riddled with gaping holes from bullets and heavy weaponry. Kiowa helicopters roamed the skies. Some Mosul civilians appear to have been caught in the crossfire. It was not known how many people were injured, but several were taken to a hospital. Mosul, 240 miles northwest of Baghdad, that is outside the so-called Sunni Triangle in central Iraq, home to much of the remaining support for Saddam, a Sunni Muslim who used his Ba'athist party to oppress the country's Shiite majority. The triangle is also a center of anti-American resistance. In the latest attack this morning, a U.S. soldier was killed and another wounded in an ambush along a dangerous road north of Baghdad. His death brought to 153 the number of U.S. troops killed in action since the March 20th start of war, six more than during the 1991 Gulf War. The removal of Saddam's sons could have a major impact on the Iraqi resistance, which has seen a dozen attacks a day mounted against U.S. forces. The attackers are believed to be former military officers and Ba'ath Party leaders who are loyal to Saddam and his family, especially to his sons, who played leading roles in the military and the deposed regime's feared security services. Qusay was probably Saddam's successor. According to U.S. intelligence officials, he ran much of Iraq's security apparatus, controlling several militias, internal security services, and the military forces of the once-vaunted Republican Guard. He was described as quiet and level, particularly compared to Uday, Saddam's eldest son, who had a reputation for brutality and flamboyance. Uday controlled Saddam's Fayyadin, the paramilitary force that fought U.S. troops during the war. Many of its survivors are thought to be part of the ongoing guerrilla campaign in Iraq. News media flocked to the tiny town of Palestine, West Virginia today to celebrate the homecoming of Jessica Lynch. who was held as a prisoner of war in Iraq before she was taken back by U.S. forces from a hospital in the southern city of Nasiriyah on April 1st. The popular account of the incident that's most often been reported, and that is the subject of an upcoming made-for-TV movie, is that the military performed a dramatic raid of the hospital and rescued Lynch from her Iraqi captors. It's also said that Lynch now has amnesia and can't remember any of her experiences. But the Toronto Star, the BBC, and a series of other international media have visited the hospital and spoken to the doctors and nurses. And the story that has emerged is very different from what we've heard. These stories contradict reports that Lynch has amnesia and indicate that she was actually cared for and treated quite well by Iraqi hospital staff. Reading from a prepared statement in her hometown this afternoon, Lynch thanked, among others, those Iraqi hospital workers.
Hi, thank you for being here. It's great to be home. For a long time, I had no idea so many people knew I'd been missing. But I read thousands of letters. I would like to thank the people in this community. Please allow me to thank the doctors, nurses, and staff members of Walter Reed Army Medical Center for the excellent care they gave me. I'm also grateful to several Iraqi citizens who helped save my life while I was in their hospital. And then a unit of our Special Forces soldiers did save my life. I've read thousands of stories that said when I was captured, I said, I'm an American soldier too. Those stories were right. Those were my words. I am an American soldier too. So thank you for this welcome, and it's great to be home.
20-year-old soldier and former POW Jessica Lynch. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with award-winning veteran journalist Christina Borgeson, author of the Into the Buzzsaw, leading journalist expose of the myth of a free press. As someone who's analyzed media coverage of events like this, as well as censorship and freedom of speech, we asked her what she made of the Jessica Lynch incident, as well as other media coverage of the war and occupation of Iraq.
You know, I think that if you look at, you know, a number of reports, you'll find flaws in all the reports in one way or another. For example, the first thing that really touched off this controversy, I believe, the first report was the Washington Post quoting these anonymous U.S. officials, you know, which is always a bad thing to do. It's always a bad thing to, you know, take the word of, you know, people who weren't there or who are getting the information second or third hand or who are just may even be making up the information. But they told the Washington Post, and the Washington Post did report it, but with a caveat, that, you know, they took a wrong turn and she started fighting, and, you know, she fought bravely until, you know, she was captured and taken to this hospital. Now, apparently that turned out not to be true because none of her injuries were consistent with, you know, being shot or stabbed.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they were a result of the vehicle they were in having overturned or something, having been in an accident.
Exactly. Now, the amnesia part, I could well believe, because apparently she, first of all, the shock of her vehicle turning over, she had a big gash on her head. You know, the doctors were saying, who actually did see her and treated her, were saying that when she arrived, she was unconscious. So that kind of makes sense.
Except that we've heard since then from her mother and her father that she didn't have amnesia.
Well, I'm just saying that if she, what happened between the time the vehicle turned over and the time she got to the hospital, that part, if she doesn't remember, you know, how she got to the hospital, that makes sense.
Plausible.
given her injury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once she was at the hospital, if she is being pressured in some way, because now she's got the weight of these medals hanging around on her chest in terms of, you know, what she can and what she might or might not say, you know, about her treatment there, because there have been these various reports that she was badly treated, that she was well treated, et cetera. And it's really, really, it's very hard to know what the real truth is.
Mm.
But this whole business of treating her like a hero and, you know, she did something extraordinary, whatever, I think that's really, that's hype.
Now, you've been an investigative journalist for many years. You've worked at several of the major television networks in both commercial and public broadcasting. You've won several major awards for your work. How would you rate the media's recent coverage of the war in general and occupation of Iraq? And what about this process of embedding reporters within the military ranks?
I think the coverage has been frightening, actually. I think in terms of the mainstream media coverage of the war, that it's all been highly controlled. I think that part of the controlling process was this whole embedded system. The war looked like a, you know, high-end video game where, you know, you saw the excitement and the technology and so on of the American troops, but you really didn't see what was going on the other side. And what the damage was, and you know what was happening to the Iraqis, particularly the Iraqi citizens. And if you look at this war, the citizens were the ones who really paid with their lives,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of casualties. And I think that when you provide that one perspective that makes everything look pretty good and like a video game, then what you're providing is coverage. You're not reporting.
Mm. Also, we're not seeing a lot of coverage. Someone in the peace movement pointed out to me the other day that we're not seeing a whole lot of coverage of the soldiers' families and that are coming home from the war that are injured and the ones that were killed. We're not seeing any funerals, processions, or anything
of that
nature.
Well, yeah, I mean, the depressing part of the war, coverage of that is being highly discouraged. And I can tell you from a very well-placed source, that, and I'm not going to name any names here, okay, but one of the biggest radio broadcasting channels in this country basically sent out a message to all the station managers that negative coverage of anything having to do with the Iraq War was just not to occur.
Clear Channel?
Well, I'm just not going to say.
There were a lot of reports that Clear Channel seemed to benefit or stood to benefit from certain proposals that were before the FCC at this time, and it might be in their interest to actually provide information and broadcasting that is favorable to the government.
Well, you know, as an investigative journalist, you know, investigative journalism 101, the first course you take is called Follow the Money.
Mm.
And when you follow the money, basically you have to, you know, there are certain inevitable conclusions that you're going to draw. Some of those inevitable conclusions, generally speaking, are when the bottom line is you may be in the news business, which is supposed to be really a public service, you know, providing information that people need in order, you know, for them to make good and smart decisions in order to, you know, be part of a democracy, et cetera. But, you know, if you're a big, big business, your primary mandate is, you know, to your corporation and your stockholders.
Mm.
And sometimes those two responsibilities clash. Sometimes, too, you will use the humongous mouthpiece you have in your own interest.
Well, I was certainly surprised to see Ted Koppel wearing a helmet and participating as an embedded reporter.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not so sure following the money trail would necessarily explain that, but perhaps what you said in
Why
terms
not?
Of-
Look at Ted Koppel. Ted Koppel, what does he make now? $7 million, $10 million a year? And it's excellent TV. Excellent TV to have him put on, you know, a helmet and go out there and be an embedded journalist. Did he want to be an embedded journalist? You know, when he, you know, puts his head on his pillow at night and, you know, speaks honestly to his wife, what would he say? I don't know. I really don't.
Mm.
But any journalist who understands the definition of objectivity couldn't possibly think that the embedded, you know, being embedded is an optimal way to really provide reporting as opposed to just coverage.
Did you notice, with regard to the news coverage, other ways that the media was being controlled by the Bush administration? Do you think there were plenty of other stories that the average television viewer, radio listener, or newspaper reader simply never learned about?
Absolutely. I mean, let's just start with the reasons given for going to war. Let's just start with that. I mean, the war is a fait accompli right now, but, you know, the most important phase, I feel, is the phase before we went to war. And as a matter of fact, you know, I did an article for Vogue International recently where I took a survey of journalists. I used the listserv of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, Inc.,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I also called several dozen, you know, top reporters that I know. And it was fascinating, the survey, because what I asked them was, what is your personal opinion of the real reasons why we are going to war with Iraq? And what do you think of the coverage of the reasons given for going to war? And overwhelmingly, these journalists all said, you know, we don't think the real reasons that we were given and reported were true. And that these, and I listed all the reasons that they felt that we were going to war. And one correspondent, a high-level correspondent at a top network, actually wrote, the war in Iraq was planned even before 9/11. 9/11 was just sort of the Vaseline that allowed it to happen faster. So I mean, and this is a comment that would get this person, who actually was doing Middle East coverage, okay,
mm-hmm.
before the war. This is a comment that would get this person fired in 2 seconds flat, you know.
And so, why do you suppose that all your journalistic colleagues just sort of go along and play the game? Again, the money?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, they want to be journalists.
Or do they just want to play one on TV?
Well, I'm sure there's some people who are like that. But, you know, I think what happens is a lot of them say to themselves, I'll try, and within the context and constraints that I live here at this network, where I'm well paid, I have the resources to go out and tell stories. Because, I mean, across the board, not all the stories they do are highly controlled. I mean, there are what I call the black holes of reporting. And the black holes of reporting are reporting on high-level corporate or government malfeasance, reporting on the activities, certainly, of our institutions that have the guys with the guns, as I call them,
mm-hmm.
and what they do on our behalf nationally and internationally, because they take up most of our tax dollars and engage in the most extreme activities on our behalf. These black holes of reporting, that's where these people really lose their integrity. But in all other areas of reporting, they truly are the best, and they do an excellent job.
Award-winning veteran journalist Christina Borgeson, author of Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press. What began as an uneventful markup of a pension bill before the U.S. House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee late last week ended with the Capitol Police being called to the committee's library in the Longworth House office building. U.S. Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio, a member of the Ways and Means Committee, was present at the markup and spoke with Peace Watch earlier today about the incident.
We were marking up a pension bill. The chairman has the ability to create his own bill, which we call a chairman's mark, and he did. But none of the Democratic members saw that mark until Thursday night about 11 p.m., and the hearing was scheduled for Friday afternoon. So the hearing began, and the Democrats asked that the bill be read in its entirety and chose not to waive the reading of a bill. In order to waive the reading of a bill, you have to have the unanimous consent of the entire committee. Well, we didn't give unanimous consent, but they started reading the bill, and then our ranking member said, well, let's go caucus since we haven't had a chance to talk about the bill since we received it.
Was that unusual?
One of our members in the hearing room so that he could raise objection if they sought another unanimous consent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while the Democratic members were in the library, which is an anteroom to the Ways and Means Committee room, it's a Ways and Means library, it's a gorgeous, ornate room, and we're sitting around this huge conference table having a conversation, interacting with one another, discussing the bill. Well, one of our staffers says, well, to Congressman Rangel, that the Capitol Police have been called, and they're on their way to put us out of the committee room. And we said, what? So the Capitol Police come and we say to them, well, what are you here for? And they said, we got a call about there being a disturbance. And we said, a disturbance? There's no disturbance. And the call was to come and remove the Democratic members from the Ways and Means Committee library room. And we said, well, Mr. Officer, what do you intend to do? And because we're not going anywhere. So then he said, well, I better go get my supervisor. So he went and got his supervisor. And the next officer said, well, I think I better go call the sergeant at arms. So he went and got the sergeant at arms. So all the time that we're in the library room, there was this incident in the committee room where Mr. Stark and a Republican member got into a shouting match. But I was not there when that occurred, so I can't tell you the specifics of that. But while we're in the hearing room having a caucus on the bill, Mr. Stark says, the chairman stops the reading of the bill. He says, I seek a unanimous consent. Mr. Stark objected. The chairman said, you're too late, pounded the gavel, and kicked the legislation out of committee with no Democratic votes at all, and having failed to ask whether there was an objection.
Mm.
So we were angered for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, that he would even think about having the police call one member to another. They made the excuse that the interaction between Mr. Stark and the other members was the reason they called the police, but that is not factual. The police had been called before Mr. Stark and the other member of Congress got into an argument. Secondly, for one party to quell the voice of another party is unconscionable. We live in a country, a democracy, that has a two-party system. The reason the people of Cleveland sent me to Washington was to be able to debate their issues and to be heard on their issues. I was particularly angered because in the Democratic substitute, I had a provision that would have provided that those persons who are under 59 and a half who want to draw down some of their 401k plans, if in fact their company has gone bankrupt or their company has a more than 50% reduction in force, that they would be able to draw down that money without paying a 10% penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Democratic substitute had been offered, my provision would have been in there. If we had not been able to bring the substitute through, I was contemplating offering it as an amendment to the Republican bill. It was significant.
Representative Tubbs Jones, do you think that this was an intention to pull some sort of power play against the Democrats, or do you think that there is perhaps something within that bill that the chairman really did not want you and the other Democrats to have a chance to see and review?
I think it was his arrogance as a chairman of the committee to say, well, if I don't want you to use the room, you're not going to use it. And you're in the room, I'm not using it right now, but I'm going to put you out the room. And the terrible thing about the service on the Ways and Means Committee is our chairman, Bill Thomas, is an intelligent man, but he's also so arrogant, and he's also condescending, and he's contentious.
Hmm.
So that causes the atmosphere in the committee to be uncomfortable and contentious.
Do you think that the current political climate, the partisan climate, perhaps in the Congress at this time, surrounding the Bush administration's accusations that the Bush administration may have misled the American people into war in Iraq, may be a factor in the political climate there in the Congress that may have precipitated some of this?
I mean, that's another issue. This particular issue just rises to the level where I believe you have a chairman who is denying the minority party an opportunity to be heard. I know you've heard on your show and people talk about this, well, Democrats, we're not hearing their voice. What are they saying on issues? This is a perfect example of why you're not hearing our voice, because we're being shut down by chairmen of committees. Even in the Rules Committee, when we try to bring a piece of legislation through, we'll be determined the amendment is not germane, or they won't allow us the opportunity to offer legislation. And the crazy thing about it all is that they have the votes. On the Ways and Means Committee, there are 24 Republicans and 17 Democrats. So he could win the vote and still give us the opportunity to debate, which he's denied us. And in the Rules Committee, the same thing.
Mm.
I hope that ultimately the legislation will come back to the committee for a full review. I believe there is support on both the Republican side and the Democratic side for the bill to be handled appropriately.
Have you had the opportunity to review the bill in question yet? Are there segments that you and your colleagues find particularly objectionable?
There are portions of it that I have read, but I have not read the entire bill. It's some 271 pages long. See, it was not this bill. It was just his choice to choose this time to be so arrogant. And I think he was offended by the fact that we chose to have a caucus during the reading of the bill. And that caused it to further escalate. But I don't think it was just the bill itself. What I think it shows is it's just another step in the process wherein this administration and the Republican-controlled House are trying to quell the voices of Democrats. And they're all connected because this is their agenda. And it continues their choice of trying to do what they believe government ought to do, and which is totally different than what Democrats believe government ought to do. See, I believe as a Democrat that government should be the safety net for the American people, that we shouldn't be arguing about whether seniors should have a prescription drug benefit. They ought to have it. It ought to be guaranteed. It ought to be affordable. And they should know that it is part of a Medicare program rather than some crazy process that they're going to have to go through under the bill. Mm. That Head Start should be guaranteed and not tampered with. That No Child Left Behind, the boilerplate for this administration, they left all children behind because they didn't pay for it. And when you start talking about things that affect workers and minimum wage, the minimum wage hasn't been raised in forever how long, and I can't even remember the last time it was raised. Mm. And an administration that has an agenda, and their agenda is to put tax cuts in place for the most wealthy people in the United States and then say, we put the tax cut in place because people deserve the money back in their pockets, but we don't have enough money to fund the safety net program.
Representative, do you think that there is a need for an independent prosecutor of the likes of Kenneth Starr under the Clinton administration to investigate the Bush administration?
I believe that with regard to the war in Iraq, I was an opponent of the war in Iraq. I did not believe that the president made a case for us to go into Iraq. Once the war was in place, I still didn't support the war, but I supported the military. I don't know if it should be a Kenneth Starr, but there should be a committee that reviews whether or not the information that was available to the president. When the president said he wanted to go to war, I said in response, Mr. President, you owe the American people facts. Why do we want to go to war? How long are we going to be in war? What is it going to cost us? What does it mean to government programs for the United States? And then finally, what's our exit strategy? And that's one of the things that we are suffering from right now. There's no exit strategy. We have young men and women being killed daily or every other day because we haven't figured out how do we get out of Iraq.
Mm. The Washington Post reported today that the Democratic National Committee has begun running ads accusing Bush of deception. And also, according to the Post, the Republicans have asked broadcasters not to air those ads. Are you aware of these ads, Representative?
I have not seen those ads, and I'm not surprised that the Republican administration would ask them not to air the ads. But what you have to look at is who owns the radio stations and who controls the radio and TV stations. I guarantee you that most of the stations are owned by people who are part of the Republican Party. That is another reason that the Democratic message doesn't get out, because the media picks and chooses what stories they're going to write. And this administration is a vindictive administration. They throw out people out of their cabinet. They cut people off at the White House door who do not support the president and his agenda.
Hmm. And then there's also the situation of the wife of former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who we're hearing reports today that someone, and we don't know who, whether it's the Bush administration or not, but someone revealed her undercover status as an agent.
Right. I heard that on one of the morning talk shows. I have not gotten any detail on it, but one of my colleagues said, now, had that been anybody in the Democratic administration, there would have been an investigation instantly on what happened there.
U.S. Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio is a former judge and a member of the House Ways and Means Committee. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.